Dave mentioned this is part of it. This book is part of a series that we're doing at Grove Atlantic. We do commentaries on books that changed the world, the Bible, the Quran, Origin of Species, Das Kapital. We in the future may sometime do a series on books that didn't change the world, report of the Iraq Study Group, et cetera. we haven't really, that hasn't really gelled yet. But in the meantime, we have these books that changed the world, and they're kind of like, you know, the For Dummies series, except for not for dummies. It's for smarties. I mean, it's like all of us, you know. But smart as are, smart as we are, I mean, we have to sort of face it that we're never going to get through all of these great books, not the whole way through, unless somebody pays us to do it the way they paid me to do The Wealth of Nations. TV ushered in the age of post-literacy, and we have gone so far beyond that, you know. So, what with the Internet and Google and Wikipedia, we pretty much entered the age of post-intelligence and post-literacy, and we have gone so far beyond that, you know. So, what with the Internet and Google and Wikipedia, we pretty much entered the age of post-intelligence and I fear we'll live to see the day when a person of learning and cultivation is spoken of as being well-blogged. So books that changed the world to tell us what we would have read in the great books if we'd read them and what we would have thought about what we would have read if we did any thinking. What were the editors at Grove Atlantic? What were they thinking when they asked me, of all people, to tackle the Wealth of Nations? I have no idea. I guess they were thinking, well, we're looking for a way to present important ideas to an age that is obsessed with trivialities, and nobody can make things as trivial as PJ can, so we'll turn him loose on this. So I was under the impression that, what with a little bit of college and a little bit of writing about economics in the past, that I'd read. I thought I'd read a fair amount of The Wealth of Nations, and I was wrong. I picked the thing up; it's 900 pages long. I cracked this open, you know, and I'm immediately faced with a major philosophical concern, a pretty important intellectual question, which I call the quantity query, which is basically, why are all the great books so damn long? You know, and I think we've all wrestled with the quantity query, often late at night before a college exam. And I'm thinking, you know, even a devout biblical literalist at a conservative Baptist seminary has got to, like, this has got to cross his mind as he wades through the begats in First Chronicles. You know, so, well, one good thing about middle age is that I've gotten to be old enough that I'm no longer embarrassed to ask the question of why these things are so damn long. You know, I would not have been able to get up the nerve to do this when I was in college. You know, I mean, taking a course on George Eliot, you know, I would never have been able to get up the nerve to ask the professor, why is Middlemarch so damn long? You know, but now I can do that, and aptly enough, with a book about economics, there's an economic reason for Wealth of Nations being so long. When it was published, it sold for £1.16, and that was at a time when the average wage was 10 shillings a week. So that was a lot of money. Now, your serious-minded book buyer demands good weight. I mean, for example, just lift Bill Clinton's autobiography, you know, which could have been summed up in a few choice words as far as I'm concerned. So economics makes The Wealth of Nations long, and not just the book-selling aspect of economics. I mean, economics is obviously a complicated subject. I mean, if economics were simple, we'd all be a lot richer than we are. But what made Adam Smith a genius was that he did simplify economics. He turned economics into a precise scientific discipline. He separated it from the unruly jumble of the mental and physical world that we encounter in the actual economy. The problem is, of course, is the minute that we step back into the actual economy, all that mental and physical jumble comes jumbling back down on our heads. For instance, when I discover that my 5-year-old has walked out of Walmart with an unpaid-for My Little Pony, all of a sudden I'm dealing not just with the science of economics, but with the science of psychology, indeed with sociology, political science, and for that matter with mechanical engineering, trying to pry her loose from the stupid purple plastic horse, you know? And the thing about Adam Smith was that he was every bit as willing as my crying child and I to stray from strictly economic points. I mean, here, for example, is Adam Smith, 231 years ahead of himself, holding forth on the subject of Anna Nicole Smith's probate battles. Smith said, for example, is Adam Smith, 231 years ahead of himself, holding forth on the subject of Anna Nicole Smith's probate battles. Smith said, no relation, I don't believe, between the two. Smith said of Anna Nicole Smith, he said, without, of course, knowing it, he said, there are some very agreeable and beautiful talents of which the exercise for the sake of gain is considered as a sort of public prostitution. Now, it's that kind of stuff that makes the rest of beautiful talents of which the exercise for the sake of gain is considered as a sort of public prostitution. Now, it's that kind of stuff that makes the rest of Adam Smith, all 900 pages, you know, worth reading, or more or less. I don't particularly recommend the 25,000-word digression concerning the variations in the value of silver during the course of the past four centuries. That particular section of Wealth of Nations, that was like reading modern maturity in Urdu, you know, but... Well, one more thing that makes the Wealth of Nations so long is that it is very much a product of the Enlightenment era. Now Enlightenment thinkers they loved to explain things. There was a kind of explainomania going on in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment takes its name from what if you think about it is a kind of a cartoon moment in intellectual history. You know. Light bulbs suddenly appeared over the heads, except they didn't have light bulbs, over the heads of people like Adam Smith. I mean, these guys suddenly realized that the world is not a divine obscurity comprehensible only through prayer and monkish meditation. In other words, they realized that not looking at things is not the best way of looking at things. You know, that if you illuminated the machinery of nature with a little observation and thought, you could see how things work. The universe was explicable, and Enlightenment thinkers were, prime mover damn it, going to explain. Now, as anyone who's been married knows, all explanations start out brief. But pretty soon Smith gets tangled up in clarifications. He gets intellectually caught out, kind of Dagwood style, you know, carrying his shoes up the stairs of exegesis at 3 a.m., expounding his head off while that vexed and crabby spouse, the reader, stands with arms crossed and slipper tapping on the second floor landing of comprehension, you know. For example, in Book 1 of Wealth, Smith is trying to explain how we determine price or value. And he says, if among a nation of hunters it usually costs twice the labor to kill a beaver which it does to kill a deer, one beaver should naturally exchange for or be worth two deer. And I'm going, wait a minute, can killing a beaver really be twice as hard as killing a deer? I mean, deer can run like hell. When we know where the beaver lives, it built the beaver dam. We have the beaver's home address, you know. And even if it does take twice as long to kill a beaver, you know, wading around in the beaver pond, smacking at Bucky's head with the flat side of the canoe paddle, you know, who wants a beaver? It's not like this nation of hunters is wearing a lot of top hats, you know, and after a long day of being a nation of hunters, I mean, you know, take your pick, juicy tenderloin of venison or beaver soup, you know. And yet, there is this core of simple clarity to the Wealth of Nations. Smith argues three basic principles, and by plain reasoning and plentiful examples, very plentiful examples, He proves them. Even intellectuals should have no trouble understanding Smith's ideas. Economic progress depends upon three individual liberties: the pursuit of self-interest, the division of labor, and the freedom of trade. Now, Smith's first, and in many ways most brilliant insight, was that there is nothing inherently wrong with a person pursuing his or her self-interest. Now, this, of course, doesn't sound like news to us, or rather it sounds like everything that's in the news, because these days altruism itself has a press agent, you know. I mean, it's certainly in somebody's self-interest to be a celebrity, and Bob Geldof has figured out a way to stay one, you know, and so is Al Gore. But it didn't used to be, pursuit of self-interest didn't used to be regarded in that way. Religious leaders, philosophers, people in political control used to tell everybody to just suck it up, you know, subjugate your ego, bridle your ambition, sacrifice yourself to the church, to the feudal structure, you know, to the principles of philosophy. And we bought that. We bought that because we didn't really have any control over our self-interest anyway. And if we were slaves or serfs, and most of us were, we didn't really even have a self to call our own that we could be self-interested in. In the doghouse of ancient and medieval life, asceticism made us feel less like dogs. But by Adam Smith's time in 18th century Britain, ordinary people were beginning to get some control over their own destinies. And this didn't please a lot of philosophers. It didn't please a lot of religious authorities. It didn't please political authorities. And the fact that it didn't please these people angered Adam Smith. And, you know, we think of irony as being a modern tone, but Adam Smith was perfectly capable of using irony and did so in The Wealth of Nations. He said, "Is this improvement in the circumstances of the lower ranks of the people, is this to be regarded as an advantage or as an inconveniency to society?" You know? See, in the 18th century, prosperity for poor people was not yet considered a self-evidently good thing, for the simple reason that nobody had bothered to ask the poor people. You know? And in many parts of the world, nobody has bothered to ask them yet. You know? Smith was pointing out that it is never a question of religious sacrilege or philosophical folly or political treason to better our material circumstances. The question is how to do it. And the answer is division of labor, what we would call specialization. It of course, is Smith was not the first person to notice specialization. But nobody before Adam Smith seems to have realized how truly central to economic progress division of labor is. In fact, Smith seems to have invented the term. It's been around, of course, since caveman times. I mean, the little wily fellow with the big ideas, he chips the spear points, you know. The courageous oaf spears the mammoth. And the artistic type does a lovely cave painting of it all, right? And this leads inexorably to trade. I mean, one person makes one thing, another person makes another thing, and people being people, everybody wants everything. And that was the third insight. That was Smith's third insight, which was that all trades, when freely conducted, are mutually beneficial by definition. A person with this got that, which he wanted more, from a person who wanted this more than that. Now, it may have been a stupid trade. Viewing a cave painting cannot possibly be worth 300 pounds of mammoth ham. You know, I mean, it may have been a lopsided trade. A starving cave artist gorges himself for months while a courageous oaf of a new art patron stands scratching his head in the Paleolithic grotto, you know. And what about that wily spearpoint chipper? You know, I mean, he doubtless took his mammoth cut, right? But these participants in free trade, they didn't ask us. It's none of our business. Unless, of course, we make it our business by introducing trade regulation. And a regulation can't be effective unless there is coercion to enforce the regulation. So suddenly, instead of free trade, we have coercive trade. And let me define coercive trade. A coercive trade is where I get the spear points and the mammoth meat and the cave painting and the cave. And what you get in return is killed. Coercion is very simply the lack of individual liberty. Coercion destroys the mutually beneficial nature of trade, which destroys the trading, which destroys the division of labor, which destroys progress. And you can have pursuit of self-interest, division of labor, and freedom of trade, or you can have North Korea. It's really that simple. You know? Now, in The Wealth of Nations, Smith's logic, based upon these principles, his logic does a number of interesting things. But by showing how productivity is increased and how it can be increased, the mechanism by which it can be increased, he disproves the idea that bettering the condition of one person necessarily worsens the condition of somebody else, an idea that is still dearly held by Marxists and, by everybody's little brother. You know? Wealth is not a pizza where if I have too many slices, you have to eat the Domino's box. Wealth is not zero sum. That is probably the single most important, most central message of The Wealth of Nations. Now, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama should get this through their heads. You know, I mean, they keep harping on how there is this huge income disparity gap between very rich Americans and just ordinarily prosperous Americans, you know, and how we've got to close that gap because it is so unfair. Well, Adam Smith is right there in The Wealth of Nations to speak in favor of unfairness. It is a position that I myself take around my house. Because I've got a 9-year-old daughter, and so I hear that all the time. That's not fair. And when she says that, I say, honey, you're cute. That's not fair. Your family's pretty well off. That's not fair. You were born in America. That's not fair. I said, darling, you had better pray to God that things don't start getting fair for you. The hell with the income disparity gap. What we need is more income, you know, even if it means a bigger gap, you know. And you see, Adam Smith showed that they're also another thing, you know, that he showed that Hillary and Barack and a lot of other people, a lot of Republicans too, should get through their heads, is that there's no such thing as trade imbalance. All trades are balanced the moment that they're completed. That is the definition of a trade. You know? Now, remember in the 1980s when everybody was panicked because of the trade imbalance with Japan? Remember that? Japan was sending us all these cars and stereos and TVs, and all they were getting for these things were little green pieces of paper with dead presidents on them. You know? I thought that was a pretty good deal myself, you know, but a lot of people didn't, you know. So the Japanese wound up with all these little green pieces of paper that they didn't know what to do with. So they started buying. They bought Pebble Beach. You remember that? They bought Rockefeller Center. And everybody was freaking out like they were going to take Pebble Beach home with them, you know? I mean, and Japanese kept buying up real estate in the United States, and they bought it until they inflated the real estate market into a huge bubble, and the bubble did what bubbles do. And at the end of the 1980s, we had all the cars and all the stereos and TVs, and we had Pebble Beach and Rockefeller Center, and we had all the little pieces of green paper with the dead presidents on it, you know? So, I don't mind American politicians worrying about the current trade imbalance, but if they're going to worry, they should be worrying about China is what they should be worrying about, not about us, you know? A lot of lessons in The Wealth of Nations that American politicians could stand to learn, especially, I may say, the new Democratic majority that's in Congress. I mean, for example, the Democrats have passed the House Energy Security Bill. It decreases dependence on foreign oil by making domestic oil more expensive so that Americans will buy more foreign oil, which will leave us with more oil here in America because no one will buy it. I think I understand, you know. And we're gonna produce more ethanol. Although in the back hills of Kentucky, they have been making high octane stuff out of corn mash for years, and I cannot see that it's done their economy much good. And the government, another piece of legislation, the government can now negotiate for those Medicare drug prices, you know, and I'm sure the government will show the same hard-headed, tight-fisted brilliance in negotiating for drug prices that it shows negotiating for defense contracts. Right? You know, I mean, Preparation H is going to cost $400 by the time these people get done, you know. And best of all, there's ethics reform. A congressman will no longer be able to get a free meal from a lobbyist unless the congressman brings a note from his doctor showing that he is bulimic and the meal will be returned. Of course, the Republicans could stand to learn a few things about economics, too. I mean, such as with Bush's immigration program. I mean, fence the border and give a huge boost to the Mexican ladder industry. You know, Put the army on the Rio Grande and know that U.S. troops are standing between you and yard care. You know? Back to the Wealth of Nations itself. You see, by showing that there was no set amount of wealth, what Smith did was he disproved the idea that a nation has a certain sort of fixed hoard of treasure, a king's ransom, if you will, of gold and silver and jewels locked up in the royal castle vault. You know, No, said Smith. The wealth of a nation has to be measured by the volume in trades and services within that nation over a given time span. In other words, it has to be measured by what goes on in the royal castle's kitchens and stables, not by what's locked in the royal castle vaults. And that is to say that Smith invented the concept of gross domestic product, and that was a good thing. It was good that he did that, because without GDP, modern economists would have nothing to say. They'd be standing around mute in ugly neckties, you know, waiting for MSNBC to ask them to be silent on the air, you know. So if wealth is all ebb and flow, then so is its measure, money. Money has no intrinsic value. Now, any baby who has eaten a nickel could tell you that, you know. And those of us who are old enough to have heard of the Weimar Republic or to have lived through the Carter administration, we're not surprised by the information that money has no intrinsic value. But people in the 18th century were surprised by this, because money in those days was still precious metals. And it was this idea of Smith's that money had no intrinsic value, it bugged his contemporaries. Smith was saying that gold is worth, well, it's worth its weight in gold, certainly, you know, but I mean, it's not necessarily worth anything else, you know. And this was, I mean, people were creeped out by this, even though they could look at 18th century Spain, which was covered with bling and completely impoverished, and realize that Smith must be right. But still, it bothered them. It was as if Smith, having just proved that everybody could have more money, had then just gone on to prove that money doesn't buy happiness. You know, and of course it doesn't. It rents it. What Smith had to say in The Wealth of Nations, it disturbed people at a visceral level, and it still does. I mean, I have to say it disturbed me. I'm reading The Wealth of Nations, and I'm thinking, I'm reading about pursuit of self-interest, and I'm thinking to myself, well, gee, I'm not self-interested. I'm not selfish. I'm not greedy. I think about the environment and others less fortunate than me, and especially those unfortunates who don't care about the environment. I think about them, and I think they'll lose the next election, you know. And then we can get some people in office who aren't selfish and greedy and who do care about the environment, because if we elect environmentalists, then that subdivision full of McMansions that's going to block my view of the ocean won't get built. So I'm not self-interested, right? And let's face it, come on, the lower ranks of the people, they do have too much money. Look at Britney Spears, you know, or those money bags buying the chateaus to go on my beachfront. You know, I mean, them with their four-barge garage and the Martha Bitch and Stewart kitchen that they cook in about as often as Martha does the dishes, you know. They may think they're not the lower ranks because they make a lot of dough, but their lifestyle is an inconveniency to the society, big time, as they will find out when I key their Hummer that's taking up three parking spots. These types, all they do is work all day, 80, 100 hours a week in some specialized division of labor that none of the rest of us understand, you know, on Wall Street or in fancy corporate law firms or in expensive hospital operating rooms. And this is no way to live. I mean, and this is why my wife and I, we are planning to grow all our own food. Turnips can be stored for a year. And we're going to use only fair-traded internet services with open code programming. We're going to heat the house by means of clean energy, renewable resources such as wind power from the draft under the front door. And we're going to knit our children's clothes with organic wool from sheep raised under humane farming conditions in our yard. And this will keep the kids warm and cozy, if somewhat itchy, and it will build their characters because they will get teased on the street. Yeah, sure, total removal of all trade restraints, yeah, that would be good for the economy, but think of the danger and the damage to society. I mean, we have to have government regulation. We have to have it. I mean, if it weren't for government regulation of big corporations, why, executives at companies like Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, they could have cheated investors out of millions, you know? I mean, without restrictions on the sale of hazardous substances, why, young people might smoke, they might drink, they might even use drugs, you know? I mean, without strict government licensing of medical practitioners, the way would be clear for chiropractors, osteopaths, purveyors of aromatherapy, you know? Well, if we didn't have labor unions, 40,000 people would still be wage slaves at Ford Motor Company, their daily lives filled with mindless drudgery, you know? And if it weren't for retail collusion in the petroleum industry, I mean, filling stations could just charge as little as they liked, and I'd have to drive all over town looking for the best price, and that would waste that would waste gas, you know? So we have to have government regulation, you know, and consider the harm to the developing world. I mean, cheap pop music, MP3 downloads from the U.S., this is going to put every nose flute band in Peru out of business, you know. Plus, some jobs just require protection. They require protection to ensure that their perf loads from the U.S. This is going to put every nose flute band in Peru out of business, you know. Plus, some jobs just require protection. They require protection to ensure that they're performed locally in their own communities. I mean, my job, just for instance. I mean, my job is to make quips and jests and waggish comments. And somewhere in Mumbai, there is a younger, funnier person willing to work for a lot less, you know? My job could be outsourced to him, you know? But Mumbai me is thousands of miles away. He could make any joke he wanted without thought of the consequences. He could let his sense of humor run wild. He could start making Jerry Ford funeral jokes, you know, about how the funeral lasted longer than Ford's administration, you know, and had better economic policy outcomes, you know. But who would my in-laws be offended by? Who would my wife scold? Who would my friends shun, you know? And then there's the matter of that wealth of nations ebb and flow of goods and services, Smith's gross domestic product. Now, I'm as grossly domestic as the next person. Where's the product? You know, I mean, how come all the goods and services ebb out of my income instead of flow into it, you know? And of course, I understand that money isn't what's valuable. Love is what's valuable, and my bank account it's full of love or something similar to it. Sex, that is, there's F all in my bank account. You see, 231 years. And my bank account it's full of love or something similar to it. Sex, that is, there's F all in my bank account. You see, 231 years after The Wealth of Nations was published, it is still very hard for us to believe in, at a gut level, to believe in what Adam Smith had to say. It's hard for me to believe in it, and I'm a right-wing Republican pig, you know? I mean, it's important to understand The Wealth of Nations, not so that we can understand economics, not so much that, but so that we can understand the moral lesson that Adam Smith was trying to convey in The Wealth of Nations. And the moral lesson is the necessity of freedom and equality. The Wealth of Nations, now it seems to be about economics, but really it's about economics only because freedom and equality are so morally necessary that without them we cannot even perform the humble but morally necessary tasks of feeding and clothing and sheltering those whom we love. or even feeding and clothing and sheltering ourselves, you know, which is very morally important, because a naked, starving, homeless us is not an asset to society. Wealth of Nations espouses free enterprise not because free enterprise will make us rich, although we all hope it will, you know, but because free enterprise is based upon property rights. And not property rights in the Donald Trump sense of property rights, but a far more important property right than that. It is based upon the property right that we all have to ourselves, the deed we have to ourselves. So it's based upon our self-possession as free individuals. Adam Smith said, "The property which every man has in his own labor, as it is the original foundation of all other property, so it is the most sacred." And Smith said that no matter how poor we are, we all have a fortune. We have an estate. We have an investment portfolio in what he called the strength and dexterity of our hands. And it is from this grasp of a free enterprise. It comes from this grasp of, shall we call it, a hammer and a sickle. You know, that is really the real source of free enterprise. And Smith said that to hinder a person from employing that strength and dexterity in whatever manner that person thinks proper without injury to his neighbor is a violation of the most sacred property, the property that you call you and that I call me. You know? Now, this property that we have in freedom, it would be meaningless if there were not a kind of equality among us. Now, there was a very well-known document that was published the same year as The Wealth of Nations, 1776. And in that document, it says, "We hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." But why do we hold that truth to be self-evident? Because it really isn't particularly self-evident. I mean, are we all equal because we all showed up? You know, it doesn't work that way at weddings and funerals, you know. Are we all equal because the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights says so, you know? Well, the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights also says, and I quote, "Everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitations of working hours, and I will have my wife tell the baby." No. No, it was Adam Smith writing about mere economics who explained why we are all equal. "It is because man, the most powerful creature ever to bestride the earth, is also the most pitifully helpless. We are born incapable of caring for ourselves, and we remain so, to judge by kids today, until we're about 40. At the age of 2, when any other mammal is in its peak earning years, the human toddler cannot find its ass with both hands, at least not well enough to use the potty, you know. The entire creativity of Daniel Defoe could not get Robinson Crusoe through the work week without a supply of manufactured goods from the shipwreck and the services of a cannibal executive assistant. You know? We must treat other people with the respect due to equals, not because we are inspired with noble principle or filled with fraternal affection, but because we are pathetic and useless. I quote from Adam Smith, "An individual stands at all times in need of the cooperation and assistance of great multitudes, while his whole life is scarce sufficient to gain the friendship of a few persons." Now, you think about that statement. That is a left-wing statement. That is very nearly a heartfelt plea for socialism. And yet that sentence is a sentence that appears right before the most quoted sentence in all of The Wealth of Nations, which is, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-interest." And that second sentence is usually quoted as though it meant greed is good, and that is not the meaning that Adam Smith had. Adam Smith does not urge us to selfishly pursue wealth in the free enterprise system. He urges us to give thanks that the butcher, the brewer, and the baker do. The butcher, the brewer, the baker, they may be wonderful people. They may be horrible people. It doesn't matter. You know, the point that the Wealth of Nations is making is that the butcher, the brewer, and the baker are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are steak, beer, and hoagie rolls. Now, that's everything I know about The Wealth of Nations in even less space than my book. However, if anybody's got any questions, I'll make up some other stuff.